This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the virtual space where you, me, the top experts and 28 minutes come together to understand one of the big issues of the day. And they don't come bigger than the climate crisis, where recent developments in China and America may have begun to shift the dial towards action. So what's changing on climate change? In the year of the pandemic, it's been easy to forget that other greater crisis that threatens the globe, climate change. But towards the end of this year, thousands of miles apart, there were two big developments. There was China committing itself to net zero carbon emissions by 2060, and America electing a new president committed to a huge green energy program and to rejoining international efforts to combat climate change. So this week, we want to know, what chance now at the world avoiding meltdown? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's get clear what this net zero target means and what it is aiming to do. I'm joined now in the briefing room by Mark Maslin. He's a professor of climatology at University College London. Mark Maslin, let's get some facts clear first. By how much has the global temperature risen since, well, pre-industrial times? And what effects has that rise had?
We've already seen a 1.1 degree warming since pre-industrial times, and that's led to about 22 centimetre rise in sea level, which doesn't seem much, but that's already increased the amount of coastal flooding we've had around the world. We've also seen many extreme weather events, such as the Australian and the Californian wildfires. And in 2020, we've seen huge floods in parts of Africa, in India, China, Korea, and Japan. While in South America, we've had severe droughts in northern Argentina, Paraguay, western areas of Brazil. Brazil alone recorded an agricultural loss of about $3 billion. And I think this is important because we're already seeing the effects of climate change. Some of the rising temperatures have been shown to have lost about 100 billion potential work hours since 2019. That's a huge change compared with 10 years ago.
Why should work hours be lost because of temperature rise?
In the tropics and subtropics, a lot of food is produced by small landholders. So they're family-owned farms, and they work outside. And when temperature and particularly humidity rises, there are days when it's actually physiologically impossible to work outside. So you just can't do that.
So the world agreed at Paris back in 2015 to restrict global temperature rise to 2 degrees centigrade by the end of this century, though they said it'd be better if it was 1.5 degrees. Now, what would the world look like by the end of the century with that global rise of 2 degrees that they're trying to restrict us to?
Well, 2 degrees already locks us into quite a few impacts. So firstly, if we look at sea level, that could rise up to 0.5 meter, which could increase a lot of coastal flooding, river flooding, and actually make many coastal cities very vulnerable. We also would see extreme weather events such as droughts, heat waves, floods, and severe storms becoming more common. It's going to have major effects on warm water coral reef ecosystems. We would lose quite a few valuable ecosystems and species from the polar regions, wetlands, and cloud forests. There would be a spread of tropical infectious diseases, and there would be an increase in heat-related illnesses and mortality.
So all those things would happen even given the action which people have committed themselves to at Paris, the 2 degrees centigrade. Now, let's imagine we didn't even take that kind of action. We just carried on exactly as we are at the moment. How far could temperatures rise by the end of the century, and what would be the effect of that?
At the moment, if we take the pledges at Paris and we say, OK, the countries are really going to do what they say they're going to do, then we're looking at a 3 to 3.5 degrees rise in temperature. And that's actually going to be really quite dramatic. It means quite a few of the small island nations like the Maldives, the Marshall Islands and Tuvalu would just have to be abandoned. We would lose most of the warm water coral reef systems. We would lose sea ice from both the Arctic and Antarctic regions. And I think the other key ones is it will start to impact low latitude fishing, which is essential for people's diets, and also crop yields around the world would start to plummet.
Now, Mark, I want to get to something which is really quite difficult for people sometimes to understand, which is what is baked in already. In other words, what we have already done and are committed to doing that will add to the carbon in the atmosphere, which, of course, doesn't just go away, and what we can do to reverse carbon in the atmosphere at some time in the future, because it seems to me that this is a tricky balance.
So I think one of the most important things that happened at the Paris conference was that they agreed on a 2 degree limit, but they also set an aspiration to try and keep it to 1.5 degrees. And that was really important because it allowed scientists to go away and actually show to the world, how do we get to 1.5 degree world? And what is really important, it then allowed us to talk about getting to net carbon zero. So this is the new mantra, which is how do we actually get the whole world to get to zero emissions by hopefully 2050, earlier if possible. But the interesting thing is, as you said, we've already got a lot of emissions baked into the system. So what we would have to do after that is, even if we get to that zero, is for the rest of the century, we would have to be sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere to basically pull that excess out to keep the actual temperature to just 1.5 degrees warming.
What does that actually mean? What do we actually have to do?
The ways we can do it is, one, massive reforestation of the world. Remember, we've cut down half the trees on the planet. We can rewild vast areas of the world with natural vegetation, which will suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. We can do carbon capture and storage, so we can capture carbon from where it's produced in factories and in power plants, and we can then store that underground. And there's the other one, which is a new technology where we can have huge fans that actually suck CO2 directly out of the atmosphere. And if you pump that directly into rock, such as granite, you can actually lock it up as rock forever.
So does that mean it matters a lot how soon we get to net zero? We'll come on to how it's accomplished in a moment, but how soon we can get there?
Oh, absolutely. So the quicker we get to net carbon zero, the less we have to suck out of the atmosphere. It's like we basically have a limited amount of carbon we can chuck into the atmosphere. So if we do it slower, therefore we're going to have to actually suck more out. And so, of course, what's interesting is we are now seeing lots of pledges for getting to net carbon zero by 2050. And what I'm hoping is, if we can then move that slowly backwards, so perhaps we can say, actually, we're going to try and get there by 2045. That's going to make the rest of the century much easier for people and mean that we don't have to suck so much CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Do you think it matters whether we get to net zero really quickly and then start sucking the carbon out, or whether we could get there more leisurely but suck the carbon out more when we get there?
I think it's much easier to deal with the problem now than to try and put it off. And also, the technology we have and the scale that we would have to actually do the sucking out is huge. And so I think it's much easier for us to rebuild our economy around the greenness and the low carbon aspects and get to net carbon zero as quick as possible. And the economists are already showing that actually it's going to boost our economy if we actually do this. And therefore, there's no real reason apart from inertia in the system not to actually green our economies.
Mark Maslin. Let's move now to evaluate how things have changed for the two superpower actors, the United States and, first, China. Joining me now in the briefing room is Byford Tsang. Byford leads the China strategy for the climate change think tank E3G. Byford Tsang, China has, as we heard earlier, committed to carbon neutrality by 2060. Now, why is that so significant?
It's very significant because, firstly, I think it's a surprise to a lot of the people who have been watching climate policy in China very closely. And the reason that is significant is obviously because China is a major greenhouse gas emitter in the world. It accounts for about 28% of global emissions. So what it does in terms of increasing or decreasing its emissions would have implication for global temperatures. And actually, some estimates have put it like, because of China's announcement, the global temperature is projected to be 0.2 to 3 degrees centigrade lower by the end of the century. So we are now on track to get to about 2.4 degrees instead of 2.7 by the end of the century.
Now, you said that this decision took people by surprise. What do you think motivated this announcement on the part of the Chinese government?
I think the one obvious kind of motivation would be for geopolitical purposes and to demonstrate itself as a responsible player in international affairs. I mean, the commitment was made before the US election, so it would put whoever that is elected to the White House at a back foot because the US is out of the Paris Agreement and does not have this ambitious commitment yet. But that aside, I think there is actually quite a few domestic drivers that is driving Chinese climate actions. The most significant one is energy security. Although like the main energy resource, coal, is a well-abundant resource in China, but if we look at other forms of energy like oil and gas, it relies heavily on imports. So China still imports 70% of oil and 40% of gas from abroad. So by switching from fossil fuel to renewable, it would no longer be dependent on security of sea routes on oil, for example.
What about the physical effects of climate change on China itself?
China is extremely vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. So just last summer, there is a major flood in central China that has actually displaced millions of people and sent food prices soaring in China. So as climate change become more severe, we would only expect that impact to increase. And that region, it was the lower reaches of the Yangtze River, and it's also a major food production center. So more than half of the rice in China is produced in that region.
Now, you said earlier that China has a really huge coal sector. And yet, to really try and get towards a net zero, essentially, you'd have to close most of that down. That would be quite a big challenge.
Yeah, indeed. The skills that are required for these different energy systems is quite different. And also, jobs that are in the, say, the coal mining sector would not be located in the same place as jobs that are in the renewable energy sector. For China, the coal mining sector alone employs about 4 million people in China at the moment, and is concentrated in kind of the northeastern provinces. So thinking about that would be a huge challenge for the local government because a lot of the tax revenues for these provinces are depending on the coal sector.
To what extent is China in a position, however, to profit from renewables technology for its own domestic power generation?
China is a major producer of renewable energy technology. So more than 70% of solar panels are produced in China. Six of the world's top 10 wind turbine producers are Chinese. And about half of the electric vehicles that are running on the roads globally are now in China. So by committing to carbon neutrality and sending a clear policy signal towards a more greener economy, obviously China would benefit economically. And also there are opportunities for China to support the construction of energy systems elsewhere as well.
You talked about China's investment portfolio. I mean, China has this huge amount of investment abroad, and I imagine a significant proportion of it, especially in developing countries, is in dirty technology like new coal mines.
Will China be seeking to change that profile? In other words, will it get out of investing in technology like that?
I mean, at the moment, the majority of Chinese overseas investment into the power sector is going into the traditional fossil fuel energy sector, so coal, oil and gas. China is also a huge producer in coal and fossil fuel energy technology, so it has an economic interest in exporting that technology. But obviously, if we look at China's commitment domestically and these policies, they don't very much line up.
No, they don't, because if you invest in mining technology somewhere else, that's the global warming that then floods the Yangtze back in China. So,
yeah, so I would foresee that China would act on this matter in terms of shrinking its investments overseas on coal, because we see that just very recently, Japan, its government has committed to stop financing coal overseas. So we would expect that the Chinese would feel the pressure to act. But also we saw that some of the recipient countries of these technologies and investment, such as the Philippines, its government has also made similar pledges to stop building coal-fired power plants. So we do see that the perception of coal power is changing, not only in China or Japan or South Korea, but also globally. So hopefully that would also change Chinese policy.
Byford Tsang. In second place after China in the emission stakes comes the US. For 4 years, they've been led by a man who's described climate change as a hoax. But that all changes from the end of next month. How big a difference might that make? I'm joined now in the briefing room by Peter Ogden, who worked on climate change in the Obama White House and is now at the UN Foundation as Vice President for Energy, Climate and the Environment. Peter Ogden, President-elect Joe Biden has said that pretty much the first thing he's going to do when he gets into office is to rejoin the Paris process. Now, how important is that rejoining for its success?
It's absolutely essential. The real need for the Paris Agreement stems from the fact that climate change is a collective action problem. There's just no country that can solve it alone. The United States can't solve it by itself. The rest of the world can't also solve it without the United States. That's a really, really critical first step. It's not just moral. It's the fact that when you have a country with the economy the size of the United States, with global business the way that the United States does, with international roles through all the major international financial institutions, it makes a huge difference to have the United States actively engaged. It changes the fundamental economics of the solution set itself in a way that's helpful to the whole world.
One of the things I think people here would be interested to know is just how big a Biden package is to assist in combating climate change.
President-elect Biden ran on the most ambitious climate platform in U.S. history, and he put at the center of it what he termed the clean energy revolution, in which climate would become a fundamental engine of the broader U.S. economy. The opportunity comes from a plan that sees infrastructure investment as a driver of building that economy, everything from power distribution to charging stations, and at the same time, completing the transition by 2035 of our power sector off of carbon, getting it out of the system, so that as you move and electrify the rest of the economy, you're starting to get deep, deep gains in transportation and across the board. That would be a fundamental difference in how our economy operates. But again, the trend lines have been positive. The economics are there.
And tell me, do Biden's very ambitious and expensive climate plans rely on him getting control of the Senate?
These technologies need less and less of a push than they used to. I mean, in the last decade, the cost of solar panels has fallen 90%. You have fundamental shifts in how businesses relate to the clean energy economy. When you see companies like Apple pushing all of their suppliers to run on 100% clean energy, you have actors driving this kind of economic shift that go above and beyond what the federal government says. You know, President Trump was not interested in supporting the clean energy economy, and yet it continued to grow over the past 4 years. So I think that with an administration that's actually interested in partnering and pushing that kind of cutting edge group of major businesses and leaders, that there's a lot that can be done.
So are you saying in that an awful lot can be done even without Senate support because business and states want to do it? Or are you also saying that the business interest in supporting green policies is such that that will have an influence upon Republicans themselves?
I mean, I think it will. And I think it's hard to, when you start breaking it out of Congress and you're looking at subnational pockets of leadership, the partisanship is not as defining. We have an alliance that formed in 2009 of 25 states in the U.S. that together have a GDP equal to the world's third largest country after China and the full United States. And that's a bipartisan coalition of governors. And just last weekend, on the fifth year of the Paris anniversary, one of those governors, the Republican from Massachusetts, spoke at the UK and Secretary General's big climate summit. So when you're looking deeper into the economy of businesses and states, there's a tremendous commitment, I think, that a federal government can tap into.
The other thing, of course, is the timescale of delivery for a president. In order to show the electorate before the next presidential election that this is beneficial to them. I mean, can you really do something like this in that time?
The transition for this administration is organized around four principles, and climate change is one of them. And in their staffing of the administration so far, and in the way that they've conducted their agency reviews, there is a, seems to me to be a clear interest in positioning themselves with a team and with a group of policies that are really poised to start moving rapidly. So I think, yes, you're right, that there's not a lot of time. The climate doesn't have a lot of time. And this administration is going to have to get to work fast if it wants to accomplish what it says it does.
Outside countries looking at the United States might say, well, President Obama was very keen on dealing with climate change. And then in comes a president after him who is not interested in it at all. Now you have Joe Biden, but in 4 years' time, couldn't we have another climate denier taking office and all the good work be undone?
The opportunity here is for the United States to really embed climate action and thinking into its economy as the Biden administration undertakes the rebuilding of the U.S. economy post-COVID here. And in reviving it, doing it in such a way that really the climate elements in it are so integral to its overall productivity that really there's no turning back at that point. The opportunity, I think, is to take advantage of this moment to really ground climate action into the U.S. approach to economic growth and to its broader role in the world stage.
Peter Ogden. And it's that final point that I want to explore a little further. The idea that economic and technological innovation will, for business and employment reasons, make it very hard to reverse the carbon control process. Joining me now in the briefing room is Dr. Gabriel Walker, who worked with the Chief Scientific Advisor's Office and now works in the private sector advising businesses on how to adapt to climate change. Gabriel Walker, can you nail down for us some of the big opportunities that facing up to the climate crisis offers to business?
I'd characterize it as two different things. First of all, and this is what first got their attention, it's the risk. It's become increasingly clear that climate change is a very material risk to businesses in two specific ways. One of them is that any of your individual operations can be affected by a storm or a flood or a drought or migration caused by any of those things. It can actually affect your supply chain or your direct operations. But there's another way, which is transition costs. If you're investing in something which actually goes out of business because the world has decided it wants a different way of doing, making energy or doing business more generally, then you lose money. And I think in both of those different ways, businesses have looked and said, we need to protect ourselves, be resilient against climate change, but we also need to make sure our business model is actually still going to work when the world says, no, I don't want that, I want this. That's why you're now seeing businesses right across the board setting targets for reducing emissions to zero and being part of the solutions. They're seeing not just the risk, but also the opportunity. The world is clearly moving this way, and therefore the world market is clearly moving this way, and therefore it's not just that you want to avoid risk. If you want to make money in the future, this is going to be how to do it.
Can you just nail down some of the concrete opportunities which business has?
The voluntary carbon market. So this is the market in trading. If I can't reduce my emissions, but I said I'm going to, I can buy a certificate from you to say you've reduced yours. And that trading is happening on a very small scale. Last year, it was only $300 million. But Mark Carney has said we have to change that M to a B. So there's now a task force that's actually looking at how to create a market that will go from hundreds of millions to hundreds of billions in the next few years. Examples like Tesla, electric vehicles. There was a time when electric vehicles seemed like there was something sort of very self-righteous and a niche market. And now they're really taking over. A senior banker said to me, I don't think people have realized yet. It's not a question of taking a bit of market share away from Tesla and making your own electric vehicles and squabbling for a small piece of the pie. Actually, the world is your market now because everyone in the world is going to shift to this means of transport.
So as much as anything else, it's prudent. Now, businesses, of course, might be able to see it like that, but they need investment. So investors need to see it that way too. Do they?
In about the last 18 months, I've watched the finance sector go from, I'm not even interested in that, what is it, to utterly, utterly mainstreaming climate change into investment decisions. It's been astonishing. And I think that's because investors have noticed the risks as well. But there's another part of that, which is if you look at this year, I really thought at the beginning of the year that COVID was going to mean that we'd stop our action on climate change. And in fact, all the big companies have accelerated their action on climate change. And I've been asking their senior executives and CEOs, why are you doing this? And they've all told me it's because of the investor pressure. Investors have not let up their pressure.
Which sectors have come forward like that?
If you think about this year, especially in Europe, the oil and gas sector has just started this whole slew of setting net zero by 2050 targets. BP, for example, in February, they reformed the company and they reset their entire strategy. They've even said that they're going to reduce their searching for oil and gas and they're going to increase all of the other ways that they want to get to net zero by 2050. I could look at Microsoft and the other big tech companies, Google and Apple and so on, but especially Microsoft. They said not only are they going to be net zero in emissions, by 2030, but by 2050, they will have removed all of their historical emissions, their entire carbon footprint for their entire history. They're going to have taken it back out of the air. And that's actually set a new standard for other companies as well. The action is accelerating so fast. We're still not going quickly enough, but the acceleration is astonishing.
Gabriel, it's one thing for governments to set targets. Quite often, the problem comes when the meaning of those targets in policy terms becomes clear. In the past, significant sections of business and industry have effectively lobbied against those changes because it's been in their interest to do so. Right now and in the future, as coldly as you can analyse it, has that position changed so that the lobbying bonus is now coming from companies and operations and investors who want to be green?
One of the things that I characterise about BP's change in February is that they've been long criticised for lobbying against climate policies when they say that they were for climate action. And what they said in February is, you know what, we've heard you, we're stopping doing that. They withdrew their adverts and they actually diverted the money towards making the strategic shift. And that's just one example of that. And I think governments can set targets and get away with not implementing them. One of the things that's very significant in terms of the business action is that they said, it's in our interest to do this. When Donald Trump said he was going to pull out of the Paris Agreement, CEOs around America were phoning him saying, please don't, we need that international agreement because we need that to be able to do business. So that's what gives me confidence that this is now on a roll and it's not going to stop. Everywhere now I'm hearing this mood music from business, which is saying it is in our interest to do this now and not to wait another 5 years. And so we need to lobby for action on climate and not against it.
Gabriel Walker. My conclusion, well, this is not an area, it seems to me, where optimism seems prudent. Even limiting warming to 2 degrees sounds pretty bad. But something is shifting, and perhaps the key is that from now on, economic interests and business will be on the side of reducing, stopping, and then reversing carbon emissions. My thanks to Mark Maslin, Byford Tsang, Peter Ogden, and Gabriel Walker. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Jasper Corbett and it was mixed by James Beard. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds, like our one-hour special on whether Britain was ready for Brexit. Other episodes have looked at various aspects of the pandemic and on the international front, the treatment of the Uyghur people in China and what's happening in Afghanistan.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.